This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, John McCain will speak at the Republican convention accepting his party's nomination. My guest, David Kirkpatrick, has been writing a series of biographical profiles of McCain in the New York Times. In today's paper, he co-wrote an article about how McCain's drive to succeed has often been in conflict with his desire to serve a higher cause. In earlier articles, Kirkpatrick described McCain's rise in politics, how and when he developed his image as a maverick, what his response to 9/11 reveals about how he might approach his responsibilities as commander-in-chief, and how his experiences as a POW affected his views on war. We're going to talk about these profiles, as well as McCain's alliance with the Christian conservative movement and his choice of Sarah Palin as his running mate. Kirkpatrick writes about politics for The Times and covered the Christian conservative movement during the 2004 presidential campaign. This week, he's reporting from the Republican convention. David Kirkpatrick, welcome back to Fresh Air. I can't resist starting our interview today by quoting something that you said to me on our show last February. And this was right after John McCain had spoken at the annual meeting of the Conservative Political Action Committee, and he'd gotten booed for talking about his habit of reaching across the aisle and working with Democrats. And I asked you what concessions you thought conservatives wanted, and you said, first and foremost, they'd like a vice presidential pick who is young and stoutly, vigorously conservative, because that's someone who 8 years from now, should McCain win, would be in a position to become president. So, do you think that was a bit of prognostication?
Well, you're nice to quote me about something I was correct about. That's what the conservatives said at the time, and apparently they meant it. Now he has picked a vice presidential nominee who is unmistakably, clearly conservative on all the issues that the base of the Republican Party cares about, the life issue, the abortion issue, as we all know, but also, you know, someone from the gun culture, someone who's cut spending, someone who's against gay marriage, someone who's skeptical about global warming. If you're a kind of hardcore movement conservative, she's for you. And they are rapturous, so to speak. They're dancing in the streets.
Has choosing Palin re-empowered the religious right at a time when they were starting to feel slightly abandoned?
I wouldn't say it's just choosing Palin. I think the McCain campaign has worked very hard over a period of months, especially since late June, to try to get the Christian conservative movement and the base of the Republican Party in general on board. You know, as recently as June, I was hearing that people were still quite tepid. You know, really important leaders like Dr. James Dobson of Focus on the Family were saying, no way, no how could I ever pull the lever for this guy. People at the grassroots out in Ohio and Pennsylvania, where Christian conservative get out the vote efforts really can make a difference, were saying, I'm not going to lift a finger. And the McCain campaign, I think, was picking that up. I mean, I've heard of some specific meetings, you know, in late June when they sent operatives to sit down with a group of 30 or 40 organizers in Ohio, and the operatives left the room convinced that these people weren't going to lift a finger. And 10 days later, Senator McCain himself was sitting down with six of the most important ones and really face-to-face making the case that he was someone they could trust. That's a level of diligence and an effort to persuade that you didn't even see from President Bush 4 years ago. And since then, the McCain campaign has been quite assiduous and forthright in letting conservatives know that McCain is on their side. And the high point, of course, was his presentation at the Saddleback Forum, Rick Warren's church out in California, where he said, really unmistakably, much more unmistakably than we've seen a Republican presidential candidate say it in a long time, he said, a baby gets human rights at conception, full stop. You know, President Bush equivocated a lot about that. He would say, you know, I'm pro-life, but, you know, the culture is not ready and we need to be, he would use euphemisms about babies welcome in life and protected in law. But it was never quite as clear cut as that. And now Senator McCain came out and said in a way that really made a lot of conservatives sit up and take notice, you know, human rights begin at conception. And if that was sort of a pledge, and in that context, the Palin nomination was a down payment. It said to a lot of conservatives, not only have I said this, but I'm going to show you that I mean it in the ways that matter to you, appointments for the vice presidency and implicitly for the Supreme Court.
You write that at one time John McCain had advocated moderating the Republican platform's support for a ban on abortion without exception. And you say now he's allowed conservatives like Phyllis Schlafly to shape what many advocates say is the most conservative platform in the Republican Party's history. What are some of those ways that it has perceived as the most conservative platform in the party's history?
Well, the Republican platform has been conservative for a while. For a long time, it's opposed abortion in any case, even in instances of rape, incest, or where the life of the mother is at risk. So that language has been kept intact. They've added to that some praise for the Born Alive Infants Act, which would stipulate that fetuses which somehow survive an abortion procedure should be protected and given health care. They've ramped up the opposition to same-sex marriage so that it reads like it would also oppose quasi-marital civil unions, which are quite common now in several states. And on immigration, which has been a signature issue for Senator McCain, where he has supported various measures to sort of loosen immigration rules or offer a path to permanent citizenship for the millions of immigrants currently here without documentation, the platform now calls for new laws that would overturn court decisions and make it much easier to deport thousands or millions of currently illegal immigrants. I mean, it is staunchly and unmistakably rigorously different from what Senator McCain has said. I talked to Phyllis Schlafly about that the other day, and she said, yeah, we're delighted. You know, the Bush campaign always fought us tooth and nail when we tried to make the platform more conservative. And McCain really let us have our way. We're hoping that he catches up with it. So that's their perspective.
So Senator McCain is now kind of in alignment with the Christian conservatives, but I'm not sure that they see him as one of them. I mean, President Bush has made his faith a central part of his public life. He talks about it. He's made a point of talking about it. And for John McCain, it hasn't been that way. He hasn't been somebody who's publicly talked a lot about faith, although he did start talking about it in a more public way at the Saddleback Forum that Rick Warren moderated. But do you know if the Christian conservative leaders care whether John McCain is a person of deep faith and whether his faith coincides with their faith or not?
Yeah, I think people certainly care. I mean, I think, frankly, the number of Americans who notice whether a politician has a faith that resembles theirs or any faith at all is very, very large. And no doubt about it, John McCain is very bad at talking about his own faith. He has two stories that he brings up every time he's asked about religion. And as several Christian conservatives have pointed out to me, neither of them is about his own faith. They're both about acts of religious faith that he witnessed when he was a POW in Vietnam. And they're moving stories. You know, the most famous one is about watching one of his Vietnamese guards draw a cross in the sand when he was in captivity on Christmas Day in North Vietnam. And that's a terrific story. But he's not the faithful person in that story. So his efforts when he does try to talk about his faith, and I think he brought that one up at Saddleback, his efforts when he does try to talk about his faith really do leave a lot of Christian conservatives cold. And that's one reason why, until recently, they were at best lukewarm about him. But what's happened is, you know, where President Bush had a genuine faith story and a faith history that he could rely on to connect with people, Senator McCain, in lieu of that, has had to speak more clearly and more forcefully about what he would do in office. His pro-life rhetoric has been, as I say, a little bit clearer even, and his commitments a little bit stronger than President Bush's were. And I think that's why you're seeing people, with the concrete evidence of the Palin pick, you're seeing people really turn around and get behind him. I should note that he's not 100% in line with what you would consider to be the goals of the Christian conservative movement. I mean, he supports state amendments to block same-sex marriage, but not a federal amendment. And he supports federal funding for stem cell research, which is, you know, fading as an issue as the research moves towards adult stem cells, but is certainly an area of difference between him and a lot of Christian conservative leaders.
My guest is David Kirkpatrick. He's a political reporter for the New York Times. During the 2004 presidential campaign, he covered the Christian conservative movement. He's now lately been writing a series of biographical portraits of John McCain, and he's currently in the Twin Cities covering the Republican convention. You write about how John McCain has always been kind of a little at war with himself, that there's been a conflict between his ambition and his ideals. Would you elaborate on that for us?
One of the striking things about Senator McCain's career as a politician is his habit of apology. He started this campaign, the general election, by going to Memphis, where Dr. Martin Luther King was shot, and making an apology to a group of African Americans for having failed to support a national holiday for Dr. King. He, at the beginning of the 2000 campaign, when he first ran for president, you know, he started out calling for a more ennobling kind of campaign discourse that would turn away from sort of scurrilous attacks on each other, what he referred to as the politics of as a spectacle of selfish ambition. At the same time, he was passing out a handout at the back of the room, making just such allegations about then Governor George Bush's tax plan. So he apologized right then, right there that day. And later on, he apologized for attacking President Bush too vigorously in South Carolina in response to what he thought were Bush attacks. And then afterwards, he flew back to South Carolina. He apologized for failing to come out against the use of the Confederate flag. You almost never see a politician criticize him or herself as often and as successfully as Senator McCain has. And what I think that's about, what a lot of people around him think that's about, is his own struggle to try to reconcile his quite eager ambition for his own success, his own real determination to make his mark on history on the one hand, and a genuine commitment to try to live up to a standard of honor on the other. And he wrestles with that. And I imagine a lot of great politicians have wrestled with that. But he does it in public. He makes a real show of it. It's sort of hard to wrap one's head around how much mileage he's gotten in this campaign out of his support for positions which he says are unpopular. You know, he really, it's a badge of honor to him that when the American people wanted to get the troops home from Iraq, he said no. It's a badge of honor to him that he was running for the Republican presidential nomination, and the party clearly did not want to support a guest worker program that would allow more immigrants in, and he stuck to his guns. It's an unusual thing to see a politician who has made the unpopularity of their own views a cornerstone of their pitch to the public. And I think what explains that is this kind of dialectic between his desire to get elected and his desire to do something bigger than just getting elected.
Do you see his new alliance with Christian conservatives as fitting into your description of his public dialect between his ambition and his ideals?
Well, yes and no. I mean, to really understand the history of it, you've got to look back at the 2000 campaign, because that's when he really squared off against the Christian conservative movement. And our recollection of that has been a little bit enhanced by nostalgia. You know, in memory, we all recall, or those of us who follow these things, recall him delivering a speech in Virginia after the South Carolina primary, denouncing Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell as agents of intolerance. If you look back, he did denounce them as agents of intolerance, but he also went out of his way to praise Dr. James Dobson and Chuck Colson and others, and to reiterate that he was staunchly pro-life. So what he thought he was doing at that time was trying to reach over the heads of a few of those Christian conservative leaders to get to their roots. They didn't take it that way, and history hasn't remembered it that way. And he's been kind of riding since then on this mythology of himself as somebody who ran against the grain of his own party and bucked its conservative base, even the Christian part. So now we're surprised when he turns around and tries to make friends with Dr. Dobson and others. But if you look closely, he's sort of been always of two minds about that. You know, he was never really against them in the first place on the question of abortion. So, you know, you could arguably say he's not really doubling back. On the other hand, you know, he back in 2000 when he found it expedient to be campaigning as the moderate against the conservative George W. Bush, he did also call for broadening the Republican Party platform so that it would be more open to, for example, abortions in cases of rape, incest, or to protect the life of the mother. Whether he did that then out of principle or expediency, I don't know. Whether he has reversed himself on that now because of principle or expediency, I don't know.
Well, in terms of having an example of what you were talking about before, about how you think he's used public apology for past problems to great advantage, would Charles Keating and the Keating Five scandal be an example of that?
Yeah, I think that's the first and most important example of that. I mean, you know, when the scandal broke, right, five senators on behalf of their patron, Charles Keating, this corrupt financier, met with banking regulators. Then the scandal breaks. Four of them keep their mouths shut. They bunker down. One of them goes out and talks to everybody he can. He gives a marathon press conference at home in Phoenix, Senator McCain. He's on every talk show he can find, talking and talking and talking about what went on there. And his message is, you know, I am very sorry. I have exercised poor judgment, horrible judgment, judgment I am really repentant about. But that's it. I didn't break any laws. And what he learned was that this kind of confessional style worked out well for him. And in some ways, he's been doing it ever since. I mean, that's when he adopted a kind of open to a fault public persona, you know, of letting the press in, of letting it all out. And he discovered that being his own fiercest critic could really be quite winning. And what's more, he made his sort of contrition over that error of judgment the cause of the rest of his career. I mean, that was the birth of his passion for campaign finance reform.
Right. And so he kind of followed through on the apology and pushed through legislation that reformed campaign finance.
Yeah, that's right. He not only apologized, but he kept on apologizing. He kept citing his misjudgment in the Keating affair as evidence for why all of Congress ought to pass laws to curb the influence of that kind of political patron.
John McCain has been running as a maverick, and he's introduced his running mate, Sarah Palin, as a maverick. The word maverick is heard over and over again.
Yeah, can I tell you a funny story about that?
Sure.
I started covering politics in the last 8 years, and so I always thought John McCain equals maverick. I recently discovered that at the start of the 2000 presidential election, in early 99, when the primaries were first heating up, Representative John Kasich from Ohio was the maverick in the Republican Party. There were long profiles of maverick John Kasich of Ohio. Is he going to shake up the Republican Party? It wasn't until things really got into full swing in late 99 and early 2000 that for the first time McCain started to become the maverick. You can't find the term maverick used next to the name John McCain until 1998 at the very earliest, when after, you know, 15 years in politics, he happened to have pushed through or tried to push through a piece of bipartisan tobacco legislation. So it's funny that we now think, you know, McCain, he's always been a maverick. That's maverick John McCain. It's a relatively recent coinage.
And I'm wondering if you think his new alliance with the Christian conservative movement affects his image one way or another as a, quote, maverick.
It can't help. I mean, smart Republican politicians, including Karl Rove and President George W. Bush, have for decades tried to be quiet about the way that they courted the conservative base of their party. I mean, smart Democrats do the same thing in reverse. So at the 2004 convention, I happened to stumble into a kind of private, off-the-schedule rally that they had organized for evangelical conservatives who were there, where they, you know, they fired up the crowd with a lot of talk about banning abortion in very vivid ways and about stamping out same-sex marriage and so on and so forth, stuff that you heard nary a word of from the main platform. The McCain campaign can't do it that way. They don't have the reservoir of goodwill going into the race that President Bush had with that constituency. They didn't lock up the nomination early enough, and they weren't that well organized. So you're hearing a lot more stuff close to that from the mouth of the candidate and from his surrogates quite publicly. You know, this convention, it's pretty much all out in the open. And the platform, the changes in the platform that make it so much more conservative speak to that. So will he pay a price for that with moderate voters? Will moderate voters who are queasy about banning all abortion or don't even like talk of abortion that much, will they take note of the enthusiasm of the conservative movement over Sarah Palin? Sure. And I think the McCain campaign has got to recognize that with certain voters, they're going to pay a price for that. But I assume their calculus is that it will pay off in terms of an enthusiasm of a part of their party that they really need.
Among the things you've written about is the experiences John McCain had as a prisoner of war and how it affected him as a person and how it affected his views on foreign policy and how to wage a war. Did you learn anything about his experiences as a prisoner of war that he hasn't spoken about himself? Because I believe you've spoken to other people who were prisoners of war in North Vietnam at the same time that he was.
Yes, I've talked to a number of his fellow POWs, and most interestingly to me, I got a hold of a paper that Senator McCain wrote right after he got back from Vietnam. He went to the National War College, which is a kind of a training program for officers who are likely to be admirals or generals. And it wasn't that rigorous a program at that time. But you did some kind of an independent study. You wrote some sort of paper that had policy relevance. And he, for years, has described that paper as his effort to take stock of the lessons of America's experience in Vietnam. So I was eager to get a hold of it. And when I did get a hold of it, it turned out to be a little bit different than that. It's a reflection on his own experience as a POW, and it tries to draw out of the POW experience lessons for how the military should handle POWs and how the military ought to look at public opinion. And it's got some provocative stuff in there. So this is Senator McCain fresh back from the war, taking his first cut at making sense of what happened in Vietnam and at what happened during those 5.5 years when his only sense of American history came over prison loudspeakers. And the conclusions he reaches are basically twofold. The first is he faults America's civilian leadership for dropping the ball on the war, for failing to follow through forcefully enough, for abandoning a kind of win-lose model of war for a negotiated peace, which he feels was a betrayal of the troops, lost the war, and damaged America's credibility.
Can I just add in here? He also says, from what you've reported, that by not just out and out winning the war, the prisoners of war, like himself, became pawns in the strategy.
That's right. He writes in this paper that, and he's not the first to do this. Admiral Stockdale, who was the top commanding officer of the POWs over there, also said the same thing. McCain writes in this paper that the prisoners became soldiers on a different battlefront, the propaganda battlefront, because the North Vietnamese were trying to use them to win over world support and demoralize the American public. You know, they would try to use the POWs to win sympathy for their cause, trying to get the POWs to sign bogus confession statements, and also trying to sort of use them as hostages, you know, say, make the American people feel bad for these poor prisoners over here and want to end the war to bring the prisoners home. And so the POWs were knocking themselves out. They were going through extraordinary hardship and torture and suffering to avoid giving their North Vietnamese captors these propaganda victories and the gratifications of getting, you know, a videotaped confession or a signed confession. No matter how ludicrous it was, they had deep internal debates over whether or not to bow as the North Vietnamese requested when the North Vietnamese walked by. I mean, they were really knocking themselves out to avoid delivering this propaganda victory to the North Vietnamese. Then he comes home and he finds that despite their efforts, American public opinion had long ago turned against the war. And in Senator McCain's view, the Johnson administration didn't step up to the plate in that context. The Johnson administration didn't really enter that propaganda battle. The Johnson administration did not lead the country, but rather watched silently as public opinion turned away from the war. Didn't rally the American public around the necessity of not just ending the war, but truly defeating the North Vietnamese. And so there's a sense of betrayal there on the part of Senator McCain and I think a lot of his other POWs. And the two takeaways in his paper for the War College and I think in his current thinking about foreign conflicts are, one, if you start something, you should finish it. But two, a real hyper-attentiveness to the role of American public opinion. You can see in that paper that he wrote right after he returned from Vietnam and in a lot of his statements about foreign interventions over the years, whether in Lebanon or Latin America or Grenada or the Balkans or Iraq, a real concern with what is the depth of the American public support for this, because he doesn't want to see U.S. troops abroad without deep support at home.
Now, you talked about how the POWs were in this horrible position because the North Vietnamese wanted to extract these phony confessions from them that they could use for propaganda reasons, and the POWs had to suffer through terrible torture while refusing to give these bogus confessions. And, you know, McCain suffered through a lot of that. He suffered through years of that. But there was one time that you write about when when he signed one of those bogus confessions. This was, you say, after like 4 days in which his captors tied him with ropes, beat him every few hours, rebroke an arm that was broken when he crash-landed, and left him in a pool of his own blood and refuse. Has he written or talked about that experience and why he signed and how it did or didn't change his experience as a prisoner of war?
Yes, he's written about it with his co-author Mark Salter very movingly in his first memoir, Faith of My Fathers. He writes with really relative restraint about the extraordinary suffering he went through, and then talks about the deep sense of shame that he felt at having signed this confession and at his fear that it would come to the attention of his father, Admiral John S. McCain II, who was then commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific. He writes that in the aftermath of having signed that confession, he found some relief from his own shame in provoking his captors to beat him again. And his fellow POWs say the same thing, that he was a tough resister. I mean, a number of them were tough resisters. But he was somebody who would cuss and jeer at the North Vietnamese when they would walk by his cell. He went out of his way after that to provoke fights with his captors that could only end in more suffering for him, in part, I think, as a kind of penance for having signed that confession.
My guest is David Kirkpatrick. He's a political reporter for The New York Times, and he's been writing a series of biographical portraits of John McCain. One of the beliefs he came away with from Vietnam was that soldiers who are fighting a war should understand the policy behind the war. They should understand all the reasons why their government is in this war. And you write that that's actually a controversial position to have. I mean, what was it explicitly that he was suggesting the government do or that the military do to inform soldiers, and why is that controversial?
One of the interesting things about former POWs in Vietnam is they talk very little about the handful of POWs who were collaborators. They generally don't want to mar the portrait of heroism that is associated with the American captives in North Vietnam, which a lot of them and a lot of other people regard as one of the redeeming elements of the conflict in North Vietnam, which was so horrible in so many ways. So you don't hear them talk publicly. You almost never hear Senator McCain talk publicly about the collaborators. But in this paper that he wrote for the War College, he focuses specifically on those collaborators and why they didn't uphold the code of conduct, why they willingly signed confessions, recorded radio broadcasts, worked with the North Vietnamese to gain a little bit better treatment for themselves. And it's a preoccupation, clearly, from reading his paper, and a source of some anger, understandably. And he blames the administration and the military in general for failing to inculcate in its fighting men and women a real understanding of the whys and hows of American foreign policy. He says at one point, you know, the charge of the Light Brigade is over. You know, ours is not to reason why. Ours is but to do or die anymore. You've got to give these people a thorough understanding of why they're fighting and what America's goals and role in the world is. Now, that makes a lot of military officers a little queasy, because he goes on from there to suggest that there ought to be some kind of a indoctrination program for enlistees, for people entering the military, especially the ones who are not trained as officers and who don't have much educational background. And that's troubling because, you know, a lot of officers now, if you say that to them, they say, well, now, wait a second. Are you going to indoctrinate these recruits into Reagan foreign policy, Clinton foreign policy, Bush foreign policy? You know, it very quickly becomes a political question. You know, whether Senator McCain would still stand by that today, I don't know. That may have just been the heat of the moment, having returned from Vietnam.
So when you look at John McCain's paper about Vietnam, which he wrote about a year after coming back to the United States, a year after his captivity, what are some of the connections you see between the conclusions he reached about Vietnam and the positions that he's taken on the war in Iraq?
Well, the first obvious one is he took from the Vietnam experience the conclusion that if you're going to get into a war, you better win. He's often said that, you know, any hint of weakness, any hint of impatience with the conclusion of a war is just going to embolden your enemies and prolong the conflict. I think he clearly felt that if the Johnson administration had deployed more decisive force earlier on, that war wouldn't have gone on for 9 years, and it wouldn't have been an embarrassment to the United States. So finish what you start, and wars should be an all-or-nothing affair. If you're not willing to commit the requisite force, don't get involved. But at the same time, his preoccupation with the management of public opinion can't help but remind a contemporary reader of the statements that the Bush administration and also Senator McCain made during the run-up to the Iraq War. The really, in retrospect, quite strenuous efforts by the Bush administration to convince the American people that taking out Saddam Hussein was a genuine subject of American interest. You know, looking back on it, of course, it's one of those sort of over-argued points. I mean, he has weapons of mass destruction. He's abetting foreign terrorists. He's a threat to his own people. He's been defying UN resolutions. There were so many different cases made. And if you go back and read his reflections on what happened to American public opinion during the Vietnam War, it's hard not to think about them in the light of the statements that the Bush administration made and Senator McCain himself made, trying to firm up the American will to take out what they consider to be a threatening dictator in Iraq.
You know, another conclusion you say that he reached after Vietnam is that you need military power to set the stage for negotiations. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, Senator McCain comes from a long line of military officers. Members of his family have fought in every American war since 1776. So the use of force and questions about the use of force come naturally to him, I think more naturally than questions about diplomacy. What he took away from Vietnam in addition to that was when the Johnson administration called off the bombing as a gesture of good faith to try to negotiate with the North Vietnamese, it emboldened the North Vietnamese and the negotiations dragged on. When the Nixon administration redoubled the bombing, the North Vietnamese came to the bargaining table and that ended the war. So for him, use of force is the way to put some muscle into your negotiating power, and diplomacy without force is next to useless. And that comes through in his remarks quite often. A year ago, he told the National Review, speaking about the European powers, he said, well, if I were as weak as the Europeans are, I'd be a lot more diplomatically inclined. So clearly he sees military force and the exercise of military force setting the table for any diplomatic talk, setting the sort of terms under which any kind of diplomatic negotiations are going to take place.
Is this a widely held opinion that it was Nixon's increase in bombing in Vietnam that led to the end of the war?
I think everything about the Vietnam War is controversial. I mean, it's a real Rorschach test. Senator McCain does not, in his analysis, focus much on whether or not America should have been fighting that war. There's another school of thought that emphasizes that this was a conflict America was never going to have the public opinion or the commitment to win because it was truly ancillary to our interests. And so what the Nixon administration did was find a way out. Senator McCain doesn't see it that way and doesn't focus on those sides of the questions.
You write that Senator McCain's response to September 11th offers an outline of his views on how to handle foreign policy. What did he advocate right after the attacks?
You know, it was striking to look back at Senator McCain's role in the immediate aftermath of the attacks. It's hard to remember now what an important figure he was. Because of his history as a straight talker and because of his role in the Vietnam War, everybody wanted to interview Senator McCain. I think he may even have been on your show at that time. He was on all the networks. He was hopscotching across the Sunday interview shows. He was doing the late-night comedy shows when they came back on the air after September 11th. And much more quickly than a lot of people, his mind turned to Iraq. Right away, you know, September 12th, he was saying, we need to adopt a much more muscular posture towards rogue states, towards Iraq, Iran, Syria, and others. Within 2 weeks, he was talking specifically about Iraq. Within a few months, by I think January 6th, he was on an aircraft carrier in the Arabian Sea saying to a group of American servicemen and women, next stop, Baghdad. So he was far ahead of the Bush administration in his conviction that the events of September 11th really made it intolerable to the U.S. to have Saddam Hussein in Baghdad.
At least he was far ahead in speaking about it publicly.
Yeah, although I think, you know, the best histories of that period suggest that there was at least some debate in the White House. I mean, we're talking about the first 3 months after 9/11. I mean, most people in the White House were still thinking about Afghanistan. I mean, there may have been some people like Richard Perle, you know, around the administration who were turning their attention towards Iraq. But Senator McCain really was ahead of the curve. You know, and if you look back over his comments, as early as 1998 during the Clinton administration, he was one of the sponsors of the Iraq Liberation Act, which endorsed the idea of removing Saddam Hussein from power. So he was clearly inclined that way beforehand. But at that time, you know, when he was asked publicly about, well, what do you think about sending troops over there? He was completely dismissive. He just said, no, there's no way. You can never convince the American people of that. You're talking about American men and women risking their lives. Do we want to be doing that to protect the Iraqi people? No, there's no way. Airstrikes are the way to go. And September 11th changed that, and it changed it fast, long before all the rounds of debate that I'm sure you remember about where are the weapons inspectors, are they being let back in, what do we know, what's the latest intelligence. He really focused on the necessity of taking out Saddam Hussein, the impossibility of continuing to tolerate Saddam Hussein after the threat that we had seen at 9/11. And a big part of his thinking at that time was about America's credibility. It was about deterrence. We have a kind of unusual record of his thinking in time because he was interviewed so often, and there are transcripts of those events. So you can trace the steps of his statements right after the attacks, and his thoughts immediately turn to sending a signal to other potential terrorists, other states that might abet terrorism around the world. Take out Afghanistan, but is that enough of a statement? Not necessarily. We really need to show the Mideast that we mean business. We need to take out Saddam Hussein in Iraq because that will have a deterrent effect on Syria, on Libya, on Iran, on North Korea, on other people who might think, let's mess with the United States. It's worth considering for a minute whether or not that's played out in fact. I think a lot of Democrats would say, well, you know, it turns out that acting against Saddam Hussein didn't really help us in terms of combating supporters of terrorism in Iran or Afghanistan. It actually just tied our hands and preoccupied us. So I just thought that's a question that deserves a little bit more discussion.
From what you know of John McCain, does he still think that going to war with Iraq was the right thing to do and was productive in the war against terrorism?
Yeah, he said several times. I mean, I think he regrets the fact that the war was sold to the American public as a fight against weapons of mass destruction. In one of his books, he's written that failure of intelligence led the American occupiers to be preoccupied with finding those weapons of mass destruction when they should have been preoccupied with settling the country and establishing control over it. And that's had tragic consequences. But he stands by the importance of eliminating the threat that Saddam Hussein posed, not just at the time, but also in the future.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Kirkpatrick. He's a political reporter for the New York Times. He's been covering the campaign. Over the past few months, he's written a series of biographical profiles of John McCain. And right now, he's covering the Republican convention and is speaking to us from St. Paul. Your colleague at the New York Times, Matt Bai, a couple of months ago wrote a New York Times Magazine cover story about McCain and his foreign policy. And one of the points he made in that article was that there'd been this kind of sense of fellowship between the senators who are veterans of the Vietnam War. But one of the places that some of them parted company with McCain on was that some of the other senators who'd been in Vietnam, they weren't prisoners of war. They were on the ground fighting the war. And some of them, Kerry would be a good example, felt that the government wasn't handling the war very well, that there were mistakes being made in the military and the civilian leadership. And that, you know, the soldiers were paying a price for that. And they felt, some of the senators felt, that McCain wasn't really aware of those mistakes because he was being held prisoner of war. He was isolated. He was in solitary confinement for 2 years. So those problems were, like, out of his view. And I'm wondering if you've looked into that at all and if you have anything you can tell us about that.
Yeah, one runs into that difference of opinion right away when you start reporting about the former POWs. The thing about the POWs is, by and large, they were pilots. They were airmen. So their orientation is towards bombing and the air war. So they didn't really confront the suffering or the gore on the ground in the way that Senator Kerry Senator Chuck Hagel might have done. So they didn't see the same carnage, and they didn't see the moral ambiguity to the war in quite the same way. They saw the war through the fulcrum of air power. You know, the question for Senator McCain and his fellow pilots locked up in Hanoi was, when is the Johnson administration going to resume the bombing? You know, he writes very movingly of the incredible relief. I mean, it sounded, as he put it, like an old friend when they once again heard bombs falling over Hanoi, even though they knew there was some personal risk to their own lives, because the pilots, being oriented towards dropping bombs, felt like this was the way to bring the war to a close. So it's true, he was locked up. He didn't see the gore on the ground in Vietnam, and he also didn't see the turn in American public opinion. You know, Senator John Warner, who at that time was Secretary of the Navy, is a good friend of Senator McCain and of his father. And he takes a very different tone towards the war in Iraq, in part because he was at home and watching the protests on the streets in Washington. And he's talked to me about what it was like when he and Secretary of Defense Mel Laird snuck out undercover to look at one of those protests filling the mall. And they went back to their office and they just thought, this is it. We're sunk. We can't, you know, the American people have turned against this. We can't carry it on. So he doesn't quite have the same, you know, got to win at all cost tone that Senator McCain does. And I think that's got to go back to the perspective that Senator McCain had as a POW in Vietnam on the way the war was playing out.
Do you think John McCain's strategy is something of a gamble? In order to get the coalitions and the support that he thinks he needs to win, he's changed his position on some things, for example, to get a strong backing from Christian conservatives. If he loses the race, does he risk looking like someone who sold out his values and who's changed his legacy in an attempt to get elected?
Yeah, he risks that. But you know what? Looking back over McCain's history, it turns out that how you're remembered is a little bit beyond your control. You know, right now, it's widely perceived that Senator McCain was a maverick and has sold out to the base of his party. And to a certain extent, that's true in that he was running as an outsider, changing the party, and he is now its standard bearer. But you know what? If you actually look at the number of issues where he has reversed position, there aren't that many. He did oppose President Bush's tax cuts in 2001 and 2003. Probably, in my view, as much out of leftover animosity from the 2000 campaign as general principled opposition to those tax cuts. So he's reversed himself on the tax cuts, for sure. He approaches those. And he now embraces those. And he's reversed himself on the Republican Party platform. He, in 2000, called for changing its position to allow some flexibility on abortion. Now he's allowed conservatives to write the platform any way they like. There aren't that many other cases where he's reversed himself. He never really squared off against the Christian right, so it's not really a reversal for him to embrace the Christian right now. So, yes, I guess I do feel like he may go down in history as a maverick who sold out. On the other hand, he was never that much of a maverick in the first place, and he hasn't done that much selling out. So I think his calculus is probably, I'd like to win, and I'll worry about the rest later.
David Kirkpatrick, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
David Kirkpatrick is a political correspondent for the New York Times and has written a series of articles profiling John McCain. This week, Kirkpatrick is reporting from the Republican convention, where McCain will accept his party's nomination tonight.